I listened all day for the knock of the stranger, and I often looked out from the door. The table was scrubbed, the brass shining, and well swept the floor. The shadows grew longer and longer. In the grate the fire flickered and died. It's too late. He never will come now, I said, and sighed. I sat there, musing and musing, the spinning wheel still at my side. The moonlight came in through the window, white like a bride. As the clock struck 12, I heard nothing, but felt he had come and stayed, waiting outside. And I listened, and I was afraid. So this is a poem written by Bhante, I think in about 1947 in India. Very early days of his spiritual life. I forget how old he was. He must have been about 19, I think. Maybe a little bit older. For some reason or other, every time I do a mythic context retreat, this poem always comes to mind. Always. Without fail, it comes to mind. This poem, Advent. And I've always loved this poem. I first read it in India in the late 1970s, when the first time Bhante's poems were put together in a cyclist-styled edition, if anybody remembers what cyclist-styling is, with a cover drawing by Aloba, hand-painted. Ashwaji lovingly typing it all out. And I devoured Bhante's poems, and particularly living in India, and so many of his poems are written in India, and it gave me, I'm not making any claims for Bhante's poetry, and I'm sure it can be criticised from all sorts of angles, but the point is, I felt I learnt more about him through reading his poetry, and particularly the poetry that he wrote in India as a young man in his wandering years, I found particularly moving, very moving. You really get his devotion and his ardour, this intensity of love for the spiritual quest. Really youthful. We tend to think of Bhante, when people talk about Bhante, as, oh, he's very clear. You know, he's put the Dharma together for us so clearly, and this and that. But there's a whole other side to Bhante, which is intensely devotional. It's still there, though perhaps expressed in a slightly different way. But in his poetry, in his youthful poetry, it's really, really strong. And what I'm going to try and do today is just read into the poem. Just communicate my responses to the poem, and hopefully through that it will give us some. I'll discover why in the course of doing this. I hope I will discover why this poem always comes to my mind during a mythic context retreat. So it's a bit of a journey of discovery for me, and I hope it will be helpful to you as well. So I've never talked to Bhante about the poem. I did a talk with him once called The Message of the Bowl, Going Forth in the Poetry of Sangharakshita. And I got him to read the poems that I was commenting on. And he never said to me afterwards whether I'd got the commentary right or not. So I've no idea. And I didn't say a lot about this poem. So it's Advent, it's called, which of course is, it's that time of the beginning of something. Perhaps it even evokes the time of the Annunciation, in the Christian myth when the angel Gabriel comes to Mary. Perhaps it certainly has that kind of feeling of a stranger coming to a house with a spinning wheel, a very tidy house. It has that kind of feeling. It's very interesting as well that in, Bunty is very familiar with Renaissance arts. Certainly, I feel the mood of the poem is quite feminine. It's a kind of domestic scene, isn't it? You know, of a cleaned house, somebody waiting for some stranger that they know that's coming in a cleaned and tidy house, waiting to greet them. The Annunciation, of course, isn't like that. I think it's just sudden. Mary doesn't know that the angel Gabriel is coming. But nonetheless, it has a kind of feminine feel to it. It's very interesting in Islamic mysticism. The Annunciation is commented on because the Annunciation is mentioned in the Quran. Jesus is quite important actually in Islam, and quite important in Islamic mysticism and Sufism. And Mevlana, most people speak of him as Rumi, Jalaluddin Rumi, Mevlana, in his Matnawi, has a wonderful telling of the Annunciation, but it's sort of read in a very particular way, that the angel, yes, is the messenger of reality, the messenger of the unseen, as they call it in Islamic tradition, the unseen, that sort of secret, transcendent world. And the Virgin, Mary, Maryam, is the soul of the spiritual aspirant, which is feminine, in relationship to the messenger of the unseen, of the truth breaking in. Perhaps there's something of this in Bunty's poem, that sense of the beginning of his spiritual life, of opening up to that which is beyond what he knows, certainly in a lot of his poetry from that time. This intense devotional poetry with titles like Aspiration, and so on. You know, this intensity of feeling which runs through his poetry in India. I also feel this. I associate this also with another tradition. Bunty, of course, in India was beginning to read a lot in Indian writing not just of Buddhism, but of all traditions, including Hinduism, but of course as well he was discovering people like Rabindranath Tagore, the great Bengali poet. And I have a sort of feeling that this poem might also be influenced by Indian devotional poetry. When I think of the stranger, and when he's called he, it's a capital H, perhaps Bunty has in mind traditions of, you know, at the back of his mind somewhere, I don't know, maybe traditions associated with Krishna as the stranger, and this is a lady in the house waiting for the mysterious blue god, the handsome god. And this is all very symbolic, Vivekarapnam and Vinod. Not literal at all. It doesn't mean that Bunty was a Hindu. You understand, good. But the mood that is very important in the symbolism of Krishna and the gopis, the cow maidens, the mood that they're in, their devotional mood, is called viraha. Viraha. Viraha, a kind of anguished longing, a sense of separation from, well, let's call it, well, the God, reality, an anguished longing, an anguished separation from that, and a longing to join with that. You have a whole tradition in South India called Viraha Bhakti, Viraha Bhakti. And that Viraha idea pervades Indian culture. It affects all traditions, and you even find echoes of it in well, in even earlier traditions in Buddhism. You have a wonderful entreating the Buddha to appear in the Sutra of Golden Light, which is filled with this sort of sense of anguished separation, intense love and longing. So I wonder if maybe there are these influences coming in on this poem. It's hard to know. But anyway, there is this person in this house listening all day for the knock of the stranger. He's just called the stranger. And later on, there is definitely a capital H, the stranger. Of course, you do get traditions in India of a stranger turning up, and you... Where if a stranger turns up, you have to be very, very hospitable. They're the best kind of guest. The RT is the greatly honoured guest, the guest that turns up at no particular time. This is a bit different, it's a bit strange, because this person in the house knows that the stranger is coming, wants the stranger to come very badly, very deeply. You know, who is this stranger? You know, I've suggested various things. The angel, Krishna. It's none of those things, really. Perhaps it's all of those things and none of them. But we also have, in our own Buddhist tradition, a sense of the Buddha as stranger. The Buddha as a stranger. I think this is very, very important, because we practice, we're surrounded by this wonderful iconography, we've read bits of the Pali Canon, we've read books on the Buddha, and of course we think, well, I know who the Buddha is. He's that man that sits, you know, like this. He's that man who was enlightened and is filled with wisdom and compassion. I know who the Buddha is. I know what the Buddha is. I'm really familiar with the Buddha. I can talk about the Buddha. I can talk about the Buddha. I've given lots of talks about the Buddha. I'm always talking about the Buddha. Thinking about the Buddha doesn't mean that I or anybody else really know who the Buddha is. It's very, very important that we actually realise that we don't know the Buddha. You get this in the Pali Canon, don't you, where you know, somebody comes to the Buddha and asks him all sorts of questions about him, about the enlightened person, and the Buddha just says, not that, not that, not that, not that, and the person breaks down in the end, because the Buddha just will not allow them to box him in. And in one place he said, the Tathagata is like the great and mighty ocean, impossible to know and fathom, strange. Buddha talks about the strange and wonderful qualities of the mighty ocean. Strange, distant, weird, full of strangeness. And of course the Buddha and the people in this area probably hadn't even seen the great and mighty ocean. They'd only heard legends, myths, stories about the great and mighty ocean. Even to Shariputra, when Shariputra does a great lion's roar and says, there is no Buddha who has been, no released person who has in the past, who has ever been greater than you. None now and none in the future. And the Buddha said, sorry, Buddha, that is a great lion's roar. Have you known all those past enlightened ones? No, Lord. Do you know the ones in the present and the ones in the future? No, Bhagwan, no, Bhante. Sorry, Buddha. Do you know me? No, Bhagwan, I don't know you. So even to Sariputta, the Buddha is not really known. He does then start talking about the trend of the Dharma, but he has to admit incomprehension. That's an enlightened disciple of the Buddha. What about us? We can feel that we know it all. We don't only know the Buddha, we know the path, we know all about meditation, we know this, we know that, we know the order, we know the movement, we know Sangharakshita, we know the ordination process, we've got it all nailed down to the floor about when we're going to be ordained and this, that and the other. We don't know anything about, actually we don't know anything about anything really. Everything is strange, but the Buddha is very strange. He is the stranger. And there's a wonderful passage in the Pali Canon where it's a very mysterious passage, and it occurs towards the end of the Buddha's life. So a whole set of conversations he has with Ananda about all sorts of interesting teachings, like the liberations and so on. And then the Buddha it's almost as if the Buddha is passing on lots of sort of miscellaneous, mysterious teachings. And this is there's this teaching. Ananda, there are these eight kinds of assemblies, eight kinds of gatherings. There are the assemblies of the warriors, the kshatriyas, the assembly of Brahmins, the assembly of householders, the assembly of wandering ascetics, the summoners. There's the assembly of devas of the realm of the four great kings. There's the assembly of the devas of the 33. There's the assembly of maras. And there's the assembly of the Brahma devas, the Brahma gods. So these eight assemblies: warriors, Brahmins, householders, summoners, devas of the realm of the four great kings, devas of the 33 gods, maras and brahmas, all these different gatherings of well, not just people, of human and non-human beings. I remember well, Ananda, many hundreds of assemblies of kshatriyas, warriors, that I have attended. And before I sat down with them, spoke to them, or joined in their conversation, I adopted their appearance and speech, whatever it might be. And I instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted them with a discourse on Dhamma. And as I spoke with them, they did not know me, and understand, and wondered, who is it that speaks like this? A deva or a man? And having thus instructed them, I disappeared. And still they did not know, he who has just disappeared, was he a deva or a man? And then he goes through all the other assemblies and says the same thing. He adopted their clothes and their speech. He spoke their language. He spoke to them. They did not know who was with them, rousing them, inspiring them, firing them with the Dharma. Is it a man? Is it a god? Who is this person, this stranger? And then he disappeared, and they still did not know who he was. A wonderfully important passage. Bhante's given a brilliant lecture on this. He's the only person I know who's explored it, a lecture called The Disappearing Buddha. The Disappearing Buddha. Well worth a listen to. It was a sermon he gave in a church in London. St. James's Piccadilly, I think. So the Buddha is a stranger. We might not recognise him when he's actually with us. He'll be wearing our dress, apparently, speaking to us in an inspiring way, but we won't know who he is or what he is. Is he a man? Is he a god? This happens repeatedly throughout the Pali Canon. We think, of course, well, I'll know who the Buddha is if he turned up and talked to me. I'll get, you know, the Buddha, and, you know, I'll be one of those good disciples. I won't be one of those reactive disciples, you know, because you often get people reacting to the Buddha, and we always think those stupid reactive disciples. I would recognise who the Buddha was, and I would be a good disciple. Of course, we're far more likely to be reactive than responsive. But this passage the Buddha is definitely a stranger. And in later Buddhist tradition, there's even a school called the Lokottaravadins, which means the sort of transcendentalists, really bringing out the fact, the wholly transcendental, the beyond the world nature of the Buddha. That's very, very important. The infinite depth and transcendental heights, the profundity of the Buddha. So it's good that we have all this to help us. Doorways into something. But let's remember that the Buddha is a stranger. We won't know him. Certainly not with our intellect. That can do useful preliminary work, but in the end we are going to have to sort of surrender. We're going to have to let go of all that and move into, well, open up to the strange. It's very important on a retreat like this to keep an eye on your dreams. Keep an eye on your dream life. There might be some strangers in your dream. Keep an eye on what's going on out of the corner of your eye. So anyway, he's waiting, or she's waiting, someone is waiting for the knock of the stranger, and they're eager. They're often looking out the door. Where is this stranger? We don't know what the backstory is to this, but there's a stranger coming. And then the table was scrubbed, the brass shining, and well swept the floor. The house is a very, very clean house. The table is well scrubbed. The brass is really shining. And you know you're in a very well-kept Indian house when the brass, with these old Indian houses who still had brass lotus and that sort of thing, and those big brass pots. Sometimes they're really gleaming when you go in, and you see the women often cleaning them with straw and mud outside. Very, very shiny. So the brass is shining and the floor is very well swept. So it's a ready house waiting for this stranger. It's prepared. All this work has been done. And of course, what that immediately brings up, if we were to read into it, perhaps rather facilely, but never mind. This, of course, represents purification. If you like, we are the house. We are the house. We are the woman in the house, or the man in the house, the disciple, the aspirant in the house. The stranger can only come if the house is clean. If our house is clean, if we've scrubbed and polished. In other words, this brings up the whole area of purification. Purification. The need for purification. The purification, and not just of klesha, defilement, but also karma. The burden of our karma. Our karma vipaka, the burden of our actions. We are held back because we haven't purified the effects of our karma, of our actions. Karma and klesha, these are the two great things to purify in Buddhist tradition. Again and again, they talk about the purification of past evil action and klesha. They're in relationship to one another. You know, not just greed, hatred and delusion and all their ugly brothers and sisters in the present. But also, we have a burden because of our previous actions. And we need to purify. We need to intensely purify. I think very often, in non-traditional worlds, non-traditional societies, non-Buddhist societies, we have a very different view of the encounter with reality because we privilege so much intellect. And we think that if you just read and know and think and do the right courses and meet the experts, the fruits will come. The revelation, the knowledge, the delivery in meditation will come. No, not like that. You have to do a lot of purification. If you're blocked along the path, look into your past. What have you done? What are you not attending to? What are you not attending to in your life now? In particular, we need to look at selfishness, self-centeredness. That's what it comes back to. You could call it ego, but that's too abstract. Yes, you do have to see through the ego, but that means self-centeredness, putting everything into ourselves. And that has to be reversed. It has to be completely reversed into something like this. This is communicating service, the cleaning of the house. There's service going on here. The person of the house is a servant. They serve the house. They clean it. They make it ready for the stranger. They make it ready for this very important person, this honoured guest, to come in. So in the same way, we have to serve that which is beyond us. We have to cleanse and purify. This is, of course, the symbolism very, very strongly in the going for refuge and prostration practice of the white light of purification. You know, as when we go for refuge, we become aware of the burden of our actions, the burden that we carry, the unaddressed material that we really need to address, that if we don't, we don't address at our peril. I was thinking about, I mentioned this great Hindu Swami, Yalahanka Swami, who was one of Bantu's early teachers in his wandering days. Wonderful character, and he had one eye, lived in the south Karnataka way, is it Mysore, is it, was it called in those days. A lot of disciples, very eccentric man. Bhante said it's, you know, there were all sorts of legends about him that nobody knew when he was born, and there were memories of this Yalahanka Swami going back centuries, as though he, you know, this figure had always been there. And Bhante was speculating, well, you know, the great Madhyamaka Pandit, who was also a tantric, had one eye, Aryadeva, maybe, and he lived in the south. Maybe Yalahanka Swami is just carrying on as Aryadeva. Aryadeva is just carrying on as Yalahanka Swami. But I told you that he instructed his disciples to do very elaborate and complicated prostration, and they were to do it to any sadhu that they saw. Any holy man, in wherever they were, in the middle of the street, anywhere, they had to do this elaborate prostration that took a lot of time, because he said, you know, most Hindus are so perfunctory in their prostrations, it's not curbing the ego. By ego, I think he means conceit. It's not curbing the ego. And that is the great issue in spiritual life. And Yalahanka Swami was, this is really what we need to, in the end, purify. But Yalahanka Swami is very interesting in what he says about the ego. He talks about there's a version of egotism where you think you're superior to everybody else, but there's also a version of egotism where you put on all the posturing of being inferior to everybody else. And he was really harsh with both. So if somebody came in with a big ego, usually a government minister or some officer from the civil service or something like that, some big man, as we call them in India, a big man came in to hear him, he'd shout, "What have you come here for? Do you think we want to listen to you? Clear off, get out. I don't want to listen to you." And they'd run away terrified. But if somebody came in and putting on all the humble, you know, very low, he'd say, "Oh, please, please, would you teach? Please, let us hear your wisdom." And the person would be, "No, no, Swamiji, no, 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 please, you're a great person. We really want to listen to your wonderful holy teachings." And till they'd be squirming on the floor. Yalahanka Swami said to Bhante had never heard this business about thinking of yourself as low, as humble, as a form of egotism. it really struck him. And Yelahanka Swami told him, however high you go, I can go higher. However low you go, I can go lower. And there's a lovely story where Bhante and his friend Satchapriya, Bhante's Dharmapriya in those days, they're in retreat. They do this silent retreat in the mountains, and some disciples come to get them and bring a message from Yelahanka Swami. And the Yelahanka Swami said, please, I'm just the messenger. This is what Yelahanka Swamiji told me to say to you. To the English saint, I offer 100,000 prostrations. To that Bengali fellow, you can give him one or two if you feel like it. Satchapriya being Bengali. And it shocked them both. It gave them a lot to think about. I wonder what Yelahanka Swami would do with our versions of this, you know, the pseudo-egalitarian egotism, where we're all desperately insisting on how equal we are to one another. I wonder what he'd do with us. I wonder how he'd deal with us. I'm sure there'd be a way of dealing with us. But what I find interesting about this story in relation to prostrations, in relation to these different views of being superior, inferior to, and even equal to others. This is actually what the Buddha says is the nature of conceit and pride. The view, fixing yourself in relationship to others. What's interesting about that is how relational egotism, self-view is. It's very, very easy. Very, very easy to sit in your room, reflect on something like not self, and think you are egoless. That's not real. Any of us can do that. It's much more interesting and much more to the point when we're with other people and we're actually experiencing directly our selfishness, our fixed self-view, our egotism, our pride in relation to others. You know, we do it probably right at the beginning of the retreat. Don't like him, not going to have anything to do with him, don't like what he's saying, don't like this, don't like that. That's an awkward customer, that's a lovely person. Already we're setting up those relations. This is the power of spiritual community as an arena, a world of purification. This is what we should be doing in our chapter meetings and going for refuge groups and all the other ways in which we're together. We're actually being confronted with our self-centeredness in very, very practical ways in terms of our attachment and aversion, likes and dislikes. So purification. The table was scrubbed, the brass shining and well swept the floor. It's interesting, I was looking at some material on recollection of the Buddha practice recently, and in this particular text there was a lot of discussion on sweeping the shrine room and sweeping the stupa courtyards as a purification practice, as a way for the Buddha to come. And you're instructed that when you're cleaning and purifying, you're reflecting on purifying yourself of your own klesha and karma. The dirt is also inside as well as outside, so that you can open to that which is beyond. So purification. So on this retreat, think in those terms. Think in terms of purifying. In order to make a home, a place for the Buddha, the stranger, to come. The shadows grew longer and longer. In the grate, the fire flickered and died. It's too late. He never will come now, I said, and sighed. It's too late. It's over. It's getting darker. He's not going to come. There's a sort of sense of resignation and surrender. This is very important. It's very, very important when we're practicing the Dharma to reach those points where We've done everything we can, and still nothing is happening. There's no encounter with that which is beyond, with the stranger, with the strange, with the inconceivable. We've done everything we can, and yet nothing's happening. This is really important point to admit defeat. Again, we can have this very utilitarian approach to spiritual life, spiritual attainment in a way that we think we can get it. Yes, the Buddha is very clear, independence upon this set of conditions arises this set of conditions. It depends upon Sila, arises Samadhi, independence upon Samadhi, arises Prajna. But perhaps it isn't so simple. Perhaps it isn't so simple as that, not really. And there are plenty of stories about this, of people setting up everything, and still there is no sense of the beyond arising. And it's only when they give up, genuinely give up, that something can come. I know sometimes people reach a point in their Dharma life where they've tried everything. They've really tried and tried and tried. And still they feel there's no real encounter with that which is beyond. This is a very important time to enter that fully and completely. You cannot force the transcendental to come. You cannot force the stranger to arrive. You can set up the conditions, like putting up a lightning rod, if you like, but whether the lightning strikes, that's up to the lightning. It's entirely up to the lightning. It's more likely to come if you put up the lightning rod. But there's no way that you can bargain, if you like, with reality. Bargain your way to enlightenment. That's far too utilitarian, far too self-centered, far too ambitious. That has to break down. You have to make effort. The effort to purify, the effort to get yourself out of the way, and then you have to wait. Waiting, that's such a powerful practice. In a way, that's one of the things we're doing on this retreat. We're doing a bit of practice, but we're doing a lot of waiting in the spaces. Very important in the spaces to wait well. Don't fill it all up with all sorts of things. Wait. That means sitting more in the shrine room, go and do it. Wait, find your way of waiting. A beautiful story that a Dharmacharini told me, very devoted to Bhante, very devoted to the sadhana she was given by Bhante, and she had a lot of difficulty, physical difficulty, a lot of back trouble, emotional difficulty, personal difficulty. But she really was so loyal to her sadhana that she went to Bhante and said, "I don't know what to do. Should I just force myself to do it?" And Bhante said, "No. No, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Practice waiting. Practice waiting." And I thought that was such a brilliantly skillful teaching. Wait. And it really inspired her. And she went into the whole practice of waiting. Of waiting. Waiting is really interesting, isn't it? You can either do it waiting for the bus. When will it come? It's late. Looking at our watch. Or you can wait in another way where you're relaxed, you're alert, you're receptive, you're not expecting, you're not demanding, but you're waiting. You're waiting. Maybe that should be a much stronger practice for us, the practice of waiting. So he never will come now. That's the sort of resignation. I sat there musing and musing, the spinning wheel still at my side. The moonlight came in through the window, white like a bride. I sat there musing and musing. This suggests to me meditation. And the spinning wheel has stopped. There is a deepening. Out of the waiting comes the deepening. the stopping of all the spinning that we do, the spinning round and round, the same habitual thoughts, the same mental proliferation, the prapancha, the same dramas and trips, that just falls away as it gets darker, as the shadows grow longer. The fire is going out, the fire is going out, the fire of craving and grasping is going out, entering into this darkness, the moonlight, like a bride, a white bride. So perhaps there's a suggestion of the promise of union, the promise of illumination, maybe even sun illumination. We're going deeper now. We're giving up. We've given up on the stranger. We're just going deeper and deeper and deeper, deeper into the silence and the darkness. And then at midnight, as the clock struck 12, midnight, the middle of the night, that's a very symbolic time, isn't it? Midnight, you know, in the depths of the night, in the depths of the darkness, even though it's a lit and illuminated darkness. Darkness is very important. There is such a thing as a sort of spiritual darkness, a kind of black luminosity. Some traditions even talk about a black light, a black luminosity, the darkness of a positive unknowing and a positive loss of egotism, or the beginnings of the loss of that. Everything sort of breaking down in the depths of meditation. Again, we need to be very, very careful that we don't turn meditation into a kind of, you know, we've read the books and, you know, we've got it all sorted out, and in this dhyana and that dhyana. No, that has to go. You have to give up and enter darkness, enter unknowing, positive unknowing. And in the middle of that, as the clock struck 12, I heard nothing, but felt he had come and stayed waiting outside. And I listened and I was afraid. The stranger so longed for, the reality, the Buddha, whoever, whatever, so longed for, is sensed waiting outside for you to go outside. And I listened and I was afraid. You know, so often we want so much that breakthrough, that entry into that deeper level, and when it comes, we're very, very fearful. When that reality starts to wait for us and we sense it, this is why Bhante talks about the stage of wisdom, of insight, as the stage of spiritual death. It's quite deliberate. Spiritual death, the death of all conditioned selfhood, the death of that, all that, everything that we know and weigh and measure about ourselves, about the spiritual life, about this, that, the other, that is under tremendous threat. Because yes, we've got somewhere, we've moved, we've opened to the stranger who's listening and waiting, and it's terrifying. He says shunyata, often translated as emptiness or voidness, whatever you want to call it. He said it's probably best translated as death, because it's the death of all egotism. The death of all egotism. He says, when you feel that primal fear, which he certainly has, you know, said for many years, he experiences primal, primordial fear. He said it would come on any time when he was in Kalimpong. He said he just had to surrender and let it wash over him, whatever he was doing, whether he was talking to someone or meditating or whatever it might be. He said, but when you experience that deep, deep fear, He describes it as the touch of shunyata, the breath of shunyata. You know, you really are beginning to sort of break up, and that's why it's so important. You know, if you do, particularly the six element practice, which is a wonderful practice for spiritual death, because you are definitely giving things up in that practice. You are definitely giving up your identification with your conditioned self. It's why you need a lot of preparation, a lot of metta-bhavana, a lot of mindfulness, a lot of devotion, a lot of faith, a lot of spiritual friendship, a lot of prostrations, so that you can absorb that breakup, that change. You know, we're not dealing with, you know, if it sounds simple and straightforward, you know, if you think that there's a sort of easy path to this, think again. It's not. If it sounds easy, it's definitely not the path. So I listened, and I was afraid, and that's where the poem ends. And I was reflecting a bit on this, this business of listening, knowing that the stranger's outside. And it put me in mind of the private ordination that we have. In the private ordination ceremony, you begin typically in a room full of people. Everybody's doing the metta bhavana for you. And you go off alone to your private preceptor who's waiting for you in another place. And the symbolism of the private ordination is very profound. It's you're willing to follow the path to enlightenment, to go for refuge, even if nobody else in the entire world or universe was doing so. You would still do it. You would still get up from your seat and walk out into the darkness to find your private preceptor. And very often when people go to their private preceptor, they think they know the person that they're going to. And often they're a little bit surprised because this person, you know, who they've been knocking around with, or even I found that with Bhante, you know, I was always a bit in awe of, but I got a photograph up in my room taken just immediately before my private ordination. Bhante's standing there, a bit like this, in his robes and long hair, and he's smiling and jokey. When I went into the private ordination shrine room, I was with a different man. I was with the same man, but this was somebody strange, solemn, deep, communicating the Dharma, not through witnessing my going for refuge, in a very direct and essential form. But it's the same. It's the same, you know, for everybody. A lot of people say when they go to their private preceptor, they thought they knew their private preceptor, but when they find them in their private ordination, they realise this is a bit different. This is a bit different. So yes, it reminded me of that yes, you might feel fear, but nonetheless, you do go out the door, you do go to your private ordination, and you go even beyond that to your public ordination, recognising that even though you were willing to go all alone, you don't need to, because there's an order to be part of and enjoy spiritual friendship with and work together for the benefit of all. And of course we know, in relation to this poem, that Bhante did indeed go through the door, you know, and you can see this in his other poems and in the rest of his life. He went through the door, particularly fully into the Dharma life, very, 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 very fully. I was thinking of, you know, the journey he took. I think our private ordination derives from his own experience of being really alone with the Dharma in South India, particularly because he was mostly in Hindu environments, and his friend Satyapriya was quite reactive towards Buddhism and kept arguing with him, even punched Bhante in the face once because he didn't like what Bhante's argument in relation to Hinduism. Just, you know, Bhante had a numb side of his face for years afterwards because of that. Yeah, because he didn't like the argument. He was quite hot-tempered, Satchapriya. Ubuntu is very grateful to him because they did so much together. But so he had to stand up for Buddhism, stand up for the Dharma, very much on his own. And he had to walk when he was refused. He and his friend Satchapriya were refused ordination at Sarnath. They walked the railway line at the height of summer. You think this is hot? Try Uttar Pradesh at the height of summer, April, May time, something like that. And they used to go at night along the railway line all the way to Kushinagar to be ordained by Chandramani Thera. So our own teacher did go out the door. He did go it alone to enlightenment. He did follow the stranger all the way to ordination. So let's, for the rest of this retreat, do everything we can to purify our houses, purify our karma and klesha. You know, if you really want to see the Buddha, if you really want to feel the presence of the Buddha, there's so much to get out of the way. So much purification that needs to happen for the Buddha to enter in. So much to do on receptivity, dharmic receptivity, openness, waiting, purifying, moving through our fears, even beautifying. It's a beautiful house. It's a clean house. It's a beautiful house. Let's make it beautiful. And listening. Listening for the Buddha, the stranger, speaking to us. Talking all the time. Reality is communicating all the time. The Buddha is communicating all the time. But our minds are so unfit. They're not malleable. They're not flexible. They're not purified. They're not fit for wielding, as the Buddha describes it. They're not purified enough. So that when reality does break in catastrophically, like as when we lose a loved one or we suffer serious illness, break up of a relationship, disappointment with spiritual friends, fallings out within the Sangha, when things go wrong, that's reality breaking through. And we're upset because our mind is too rigid, too hard, too impure to take it in. If we were really purified and flexible and malleable, if our consciousness was like that, we'd be encountering the Buddha all the time. But he is speaking. He is talking. I want to end not with a Buddhist text, very beautiful piece of writing that I read sometimes. It's actually from a great Andalusian Sufi named Ibn Arabi, one of the great giants of Sufi literature. And this is, if you like, let's call it reality. He doesn't say who it is. He doesn't call it Allah or anything like that. And let's call it reality. Let's call it the stranger speaking, trying to get through to us, trying to break through to us. There all the time. But we're not listening. Dearly beloved, I have called you so often, and you have not heard me. I have shown myself to you so often, and you have not seen me. I have made myself fragrant so often, and you have not smelled me. Savorous food, and you have not tasted me. Why can you not reach me through the object you touch, or breathe me through sweet perfumes? Why do you not see me? Why do you not hear me? Why? For you, my delights surpass all other delights, and the pleasure I procure you surpasses all other pleasures. For you, I am preferable to all other good things. I am beauty. I am grace. Love me. Love me alone. Love yourself in me alone. Attach yourself to me. No one is more inward than I. Others love you for their own sakes. I love you for yourself. And you, you flee from me. Dearly beloved, you cannot treat me fairly, for if you approach me, it is because I have approached you. I am nearer to you than yourself, than your soul, than your breath. Who among creatures would treat you as I do? Be mine. Be for me as you are in me, though you are not even aware of it. Dearly beloved, let us go toward union. And if we find the road that leads to separation, we will destroy separation. Let us go hand in hand. Let us enter the presence of truth. Let it be our judge and imprint its seal upon our union forever.